Dealing with conflict is never easy, but it's made even more difficult when we view conflict through the traditional perspective that has been applied to this aspect of human behavior. The older and outdated view that I call the traditional viewpoint suggests that conflict is caused by troublemakers. People who raise issues or push for solutions are sometimes thought of as boat rockers, stirring up trouble. Those who do it are sometimes labeled as bad, disloyal, whistleblowers. And because it disturbs the status quo or the peace of the moment, some think conflict should be avoided. This view is often held in both business and home environments, professional and personal relationships. A second view of conflict has emerged in the last 20 years since we've begun to understand the causes of conflict and the ways in which people tend to defend whatever conditions exist. One of the things we now understand is that most conflict occurs as a natural result of change. So much change is occurring within society in general and within our own professional fields of endeavor that older, more comfortable ways of doing things are continually challenged. So conflict is not caused by people who are trying to upset the apple cart as much as it is, in fact, a natural result, a consequence of rapid and numerous changes. A second thing that we've learned is that conflict is inevitable. Even if we trained everybody in the world in techniques of how to win friends and influence people, there would still be conflict. The conflict inevitability is caused by the fact that individuals always seek to maximize their own position. And as the positions of others around them are continually changing, conflict becomes inevitable, often necessary, and increasingly found to even be beneficial. Conflict can produce better conditions than now exist. And lastly, modern conflict theory tells us that conflict can be managed. Once we understand that conflict is a natural result of change, that it is often inevitable, and that it has possible beneficial consequences, then we'll want to move rapidly to understand how to manage change, both to reduce its immediate discomfort as well as to reach the more positive goals in which it can result. The excellent work done by Dr. Alan Burke identified that there are only 5 major ways in which conflict can be handled. Burke's analysis pictures conflict handling approaches as focusing in different directions. The first technique, forcing the other person to go along with your point of view, basically suggests that the conflict can be managed by forcing the other person to abandon their position in a win-lose situation so that you get totally what you want. Typically, forcing is what we see as a conflict management approach among children who try with more or less success to dominate particular situations while they play. A second approach is to abdicate your own position and your own direction and comply with what the other party is asking. In this instance, you're withdrawing from the battlefield and going with that other person, retreating or avoiding the problem, moving away from the problem. And while withdrawing makes the other party in the conflict situation feel good, it means you've lost everything you wanted. A third approach to dealing with conflict is smoothing. In smoothing, we basically put oil on the water, the best face on the situation, but do not face the real issue. Often in group dynamics, we'll see a person who is quite uncomfortable with the fact that conflict has emerged between some of the parties in the group, and he tries to pat everybody's hand and say, "Now, now." We're more likely to see smoothing behaviors as an approach to handling conflict at a work setting where, politically, we must all get along with each other and pretend there is no problem, as opposed to a marriage or other personal relationship wherein we tend to be more direct in confronting the issues. A fourth possible approach to handling conflict is compromise. Compromise is a word that's attracted a lot of supporters. On the surface, it would appear to be the only conflict handling approach that makes sense. and it certainly sounds better than those approaches that have been discussed thus far, compromise is in reality a co-promising where I'll agree to give up part of what I want in order to get something if you'll agree to do the same. The value of compromising is that usually both parties win something. But a compromise is also an agreement to surrender some of what each party wanted, so it becomes a partial victory and a partial loss. One of the biggest mistakes in conflict management is that compromising often winds up costing you more than what you take away from it. Lastly, Burke identified problem solving as the final conflict handling approach. In problem solving, the participants agree to move the conflict away from confrontation and try to assist each other in solving the problems which generated the conflict. Under the problem-solving approach, I want to win, but I'm also interested that you win. If the atmosphere is right, together we might be able to be creative enough to come up with a third direction, a new course of action with which we might both agree. It doesn't have to be simply my way or simply your way, but perhaps our way. In one study, a large number of managers were asked to rate each of these five approaches in terms of effectiveness. How well had that approach actually worked? Not surprisingly, no one in the test group rated withdrawal from the situation as effective, and 9% of the group rated it as ineffective. It had damaged them to withdraw. In short, you're not going to win by withdrawing, and you may lose by withdrawing from the situation. Some other approach to conflict management must be taken. It was also discovered that smoothing, the attempt to gloss over the problem, was rated as effective by no one. And 2% said that in the long haul, the approach had even proven to be ineffective. That is, it was worse than if they had done nothing at all. Compromise was the first of the five conflict handling approaches that seemed to have any positive impact. 11% of the managers sampled reported that in a compromise situation they found it to be effective. Yet 6% of the managers said that the compromise had left a bad taste in their mouths, that they had to give up so much to get what they had gained that it was not satisfactory in the long term. Forcing was the first of the five remedies to be positively rated by a substantial percentage of managers. 25% reported that forcing the other person to comply had been effective for them. Unfortunately, 79% of the managers, people with power, often people with power over those that they forced, reported that in the long run, this approach had worked against their own best interests, and therefore rated it as ineffective. Now consider this. Up to this point in our discussion, this research shows that withdrawal, smoothing, compromising, and forcing techniques were all rated as effective by none or only a minority of managers, and only compromise was rated as effective by a larger percentage of the test group then rated it ineffective. Let me repeat that. Up to this point in our discussion, this research shows that withdrawal, smoothing, compromising, and forcing techniques were all rated as effective by none or only a minority of managers. And of these four, only compromise was rated as effective by a larger percentage of the test group than rated it ineffective. Only when we get to the fifth conflict handling approach, problem solving, do we start to see large numbers of managers reporting that this was an effective technique. 59% indicated that when the parties could focus on the issues, use a rational approach, try to work creatively toward finding a way to work out the differences, was success achieved. When rated for ineffectiveness, none of the managers surveyed reported that a problem-solving approach had backfired. That is not to say that trying a problem-solving approach always succeeded. With some people and some issues, problem-solving will not work. But having tried that approach, managers said that even when they could not successfully resolve the conflict, having taken a problem-solving approach had never backfired on them. These numbers are particularly important because they give us a foundation from the experience of others of what seems to work. From a stress management perspective, there's much less stress involved in a problem-solving approach than in any of the other approaches discussed. Not only is a sense of self-respect maintained, but the decibel level of the communication is substantially lower. Can we, in our approach to others, stop trying to force other people to do things our way? Aggression does not work. Can we also stop withdrawing from difficult situations? Submission does not work. And while smoothing and using nice words may be oh so nice and it makes everybody feel good, can we realize that too doesn't work because it doesn't grapple with the issues? Let's instead assume the best of motivations in others and just really approach people knowing they want to find a creative solution. Let's help them find an answer to their needs, and in that giving, open way, disarm the contentious. Maybe a compromise is all we'll be able to walk away with, but maybe we could walk away with much more. While this program can only touch on certain aspects of stress, change, and conflict management, there are certain basic conclusions that come from this field of study that everyone should keep in mind as they try to deal with ticklish situations. I have summarized these into 6 conflict caveats, warnings, if you will, or helpful guideposts that may assist you at the times you feel most pressured. The first of these is to remember that conflict is only a game. In this game of life, people are trying to manifest and maximize their own positions. Certainly, we care that our beliefs and what they stand for prevails, and it is important that we care about winning in this game. But while you should care, don't care too much. Don't care at the expense of your own health and well-being. The price that we too often see paid in the area of conflict management by people who get too emotionally involved is that they lose their dispassionate viewpoint and reason and become overly aggressive. The issue which they are espousing gets lost between their emotions and the other person's negative reactions. Said Thomas Jefferson, who knew a thing or two about how to negotiate to win, "Nothing gives a person so much advantage over another as to remain always cool and unruffled under all circumstances." A second conflict caveat is to remember that conflict is an opportunity to learn and benefit. Some people view conflict as such a terrible and distasteful negative that they don't recognize some of the other values inherent in a conflict situation. Conflict presents a new and totally different perspective. If you're in management, others may be afraid to tell you some of the things that come to light only under conditions of conflict and emotion. If you're smart, you'll listen to this naked truth, as unpleasant as it may be, and gain from it. If you can maintain this attitude during the conflict, it puts you in the position of being a stable force within the negotiation itself. As Walt Whitman phrased it, "Have you learned lessons only from those who agreed with you and stood aside for you? Have you not learned great lessons from those who braced themselves against you and disputed the passage with you?" A third conflict caveat is to remember to never judge the actions or the motives of another. Never cause the other person to lose face. It's often tempting to write off the other person in a conflict situation with us and to simply denigrate them as being a bad, incompetent person. We try to read more into the situation than really is there and interpret the conflict as a personal attack, so that what should be a discussion of issues becomes an attack on the other person's personality and humanity. Never in a conflict situation try to read more into it than is there. Always leave the other party with a feeling of self-respect, because you're going to have to live or work with this person again. None of us knows what difficulties the other person is dealing with or what has caused them to reach some of the positions they've reached. As Kurt Vonnegut wrote, "I was the victim of a series of accidents, as are we all." The fourth caveat is never lose self-control. The loss of self-control is an emotional reaction during which we're simply letting off steam. That's going to do absolutely nothing to resolve the problem at hand, and it's liable to increase the psychological distance between you and the other party, the party that you're trying to get through to. In the screenplay, even Don Corleone, the Godfather, says, "Never get angry, never make a threat, just reason with people." The fifth caveat, don't expect total victories. "Politics is the art of the possible," wrote Lyndon Johnson. And in the area of conflict management, you have to realize that you're not there to win every single issue, every single time, exactly the way in which you want. What you're really after is to make some forward progress in the solution of some problem. Can you obtain partial progress, partial victories, consistently in the right direction? That's all winning is. A final conflict caveat would be to remember that your self-esteem does not depend on winning the negotiation or conflict. If you don't win on a particular issue, whether personal or professional, you're no less beautiful, no less intelligent, no less worthy than before you entered that discussion. Some people get so emotionally involved that they cannot separate themselves from the issue. You can have the objectivity to understand that the decisions of the moment that go against you do not reduce you. As Rocky Marciano, former heavyweight champion, used to say, "It don't matter how many times they knock you down. What counts is how many times you get up." If today you don't prevail, you'll be back. While change and conflict are stressful situational events, proper approaches to people that recognize their internal dynamics and that recognize the dynamics within ourselves can go a long way toward easing through these transitions. As you become a master of human relationships, you too will experience the fun of riding the beasts of stress, change, and conflict, rather than letting them ride you.
This concludes Strategies for Stress-Free Living with Clay Shearman. I'm John DeRemus, and I trust you've gained as many valuable insights from this program as I have. I'd like now to present a brief excerpt from Dr. Shearman's management program, The Uncommon Leader, which I mentioned briefly in the introduction.
Are you an uncommon leader? Have you moved past the phony minefield of the popular advice-giving, how-to-be-successful-in-management books that fill the newsstands? Do you understand what you have to do in terms of the ABCs of competent, career-oriented management? Are you using the solid base of what it takes to get yourself into a position where you can make your full contribution? Do you have what it takes to reach down inside you and be more than what you'll ever read about being in any management text? Uncommon leaders are really at heart common men and women who reach beyond their present capabilities and who play consistently over their heads, who give more to the job than the job can ever give to them. There exists today such a need for leadership and such a need to deal with the problems that have been generated in the decade of the 70s. The dimension of that leadership need is immense. And there may have been some losses that we've incurred in the decade of the 70s. But now in the 80s, and as we contemplate where we're going to be in the 90s, we need to consider that while we've had some losses, we need now to look for the seeds of victory. Right now in your own organization, right now in your range of knowledge, are certain opportunities. Right now, immediately adjacent to you, is a moment which could be seized and used for real advantage. I'm wondering how you look at your own role and how you see yourself and what kind of strength of ego and self-identification you have and sense of mission you have. Alfred North Whitehead, one of the greatest educational philosophers that this country has ever produced, put it this way: a great society is a society in which men of business think greatly of their function. If you believe you were born to be a player, then you are an uncommon leader.